Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. On screen, Bill Paxton has done just about everything. He has fished out wreckage from the Titanic, practiced polygamy, been a drag queen, and a mild-mannered but murderous widower. He has hung around in zero gravity and at the OK Corral, been chased by tornadoes, aliens, the Terminator, and one really gigantic ape. Of course, those are things he has only done in character, or at least we'll offer him the benefit of the doubt on that. So we've invited him to talk about what it takes to make all of those things somehow seem real and believable. Bill Paxton is in town this weekend for the AFI Dallas International Film Festival, which features the new film The Good Life, on which his credits include actor and executive producer. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me on your show.
So Big Love has turned into this huge hit for HBO, and I'm curious if you remember the summary statement, the sort of one sentence that someone handed you the script and said, this is what this project is.
I just heard it was about polygamy, and I thought, well, what the heck is that? I mean, not what is it, but what could that be about? And when I read it, I thought, well, it's so about so much more than that. The writers, the creators have been so clever about finding this weird kind of lens to refract kind of contemporary mores about society and what's taboo. And these people, you come to realize, are really four adults who've entered into a marriage contract. And, you know, the modern world is so full of, there's just so many things to try to keep going. We've all become kind of gerbils on a wheel with all them. And even though our lives have been made more convenient, let's say, all the multitasking and just trying to be a father and a husband and have a career and try to be ambitious and you know, and also fulfilled on a spiritual level even as well. Multiply that times three, and it becomes really interesting. We've just finished the second season. I'm thrashed. I got down here last night for the kickoff of the AFI Dallas Film Festival. It's great to be down here for the inaugural event, and I do have a film I'm supporting. I got to mentor a young filmmaker named Steve Barra, who wrote and directed The Good Life, and we're going to show on Saturday night at the Angelica Center, mm-hmm. I believe.
Talk about your character in that movie, The Good Life, because it's certainly different from, I think, this is a stretch to say this with you, but it's different from anything you've played before.
Well, probably, and not so much. We all play aspects of ourselves. Years ago, I was doing One False Move in Arkansas, and Carl Franklin, who'd been an actor himself, was directing me in that. And I was kind of, he thought I was working too hard and in the scene. And he said, Bill, let me tell you something. He says, the camera's not interested in what you can do. It's interested in who you are. And you're interesting enough. And I thought, I am. I really am, you know. And when you learn to accept that, you know, because all we, any of us have is who we are as individuals. That's what makes us special. And, you know, when you accept that and you start to go on with that, you realize that all the characters you play really are facets of you, possibilities of how you could be or how you would react. I play a small supporting role in The Good Life. There wasn't really a lot of parts that I suited. I did it to kind of help out. Sometimes you do these roles and people think, gosh, she's available for bar mitzvahs and all
children's parties. And
well, you know, he was big. he had that tornado movie. What happened there? But Big Love's given me a great canvas in which to kind of explore a great lead character. And, you know, I won the trifecta with these leading ladies. So I had a chance to kind of take a break this time last year, and go up to Winnipeg and help Steve Barra get a cast together. I recruited Harry Dean Stanton from Big Love, who plays Roman, to play a wonderful character. The film has a little bit of a feeling to one of the great Texas movies that was made in Texas, one of my all-time favorites by Peter Bogdanovich, The Last Picture Show.
Mm-hmm.
And it centers around a kind of a dying theater in a little town in Lincoln, Nebraska, where a boy, a few years out of high school, helps this old guy, Harry Dean, kind of keep this theater going. And that's just one element of the story. But throughout the movie, there are some great classic references. There's a few films you see from kind of the golden age of Hollywood in a way. There's a Western, you see an Alan Ladd, piece of an Alan Ladd movie, and you see a piece of the Harvey Girls, you know, a classic musical. You see the Incredible Speech. I don't want to give too much away about the film, but do you remember when Charlie Chaplin, at the end of The Great Dictator, he turns, he's still in costume and makeup, but he becomes himself and just giving this kind of plea to humanity and the insanity that's about to ensue.
It's a weird sort of softening there.
It is, but it's very compelling, and he finds a way to use that in the kind of the climax of the movie, and I thought it was a great way of paying homage. Homage. A lot of people think homage when you kind of like copy a shot from somebody's movie. Well, I guess that's kind of an homage in a way, but this was to me truly an homage.
Is it harder for you now that you have directed yourself to take direction from other people?
Yes. To be perfectly candid, it is. It's what's interesting about the show is we shoot 12 one-hour episodes, and we have a lot of different directors. We probably have about 10 directors. A couple will come back and do two episodes a season. And that's kind of a strange adjustment, but it keeps the show fresh as well. The creators, Mark Olson and Will Sheffer, are very, they're great overseers. They're real filmmakers. So they're watching every aspect of it. And I think I and the directors and the rest of the cast, we looked to them for a lot of the overall guidance of the characters, and they're bright, they're great, and so that's a challenge. It's not that I don't want to be directed. I think you always want direction, but sometimes it depends on the filmmaker. I pretty much like to be directed anyway.
You like to be, yeah, because some actors want to be sort of left alone and come up with it on their own and just be told, here's your mark and here's where the light will be. You want more than that.
It's more like a kind of a sporting event to me, in terms of as the athlete is trained for a certain competition, and there's coaches and everything. If a good idea can come from any quarter. I've had cameramen suggest something when I was just a way to fill the frame better. And thought, gosh, thank you for telling me that. And them saying, well, I wasn't sure if I could say that to you. Because, you know, a lot of times, hey, what are you telling me or whatever. And you don't want to get too many voices in your head when you're trying to interpret a role. But I like that help. And I think when the bell rings, you come out swinging. And if your coach has helped you. I've worked with a great coach for years who I attribute all of my success to. A man named Vincent Chase. He was one of the last of the MGM studio coaches. He's in his 70s now, and I met him about 20 years ago through a couple of actors I'd worked with and admired.
He was in Frailty, right?
He's in Frailty,
yeah.
And weirdly enough, I produced a film that I was in with Mark Wahlberg called Traveler this was back in the mid-90s or late 90s, and Vince had a great role in that. And so when the Entourage came around, they named the character Vincent Chase, which is funny. A lot of people don't know that connection.
And that it is named after him specifically?
Named after Vince, yeah.
Very cool. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. My guest is actor, director, and producer Bill Paxton. I'm also curious about, not just on Big Love, but even from movie set to movie set, what a strange cultural adjustment it must be to... As an actor, some elements of your job are the same every time, but you have to get used to the way this director likes to set things up and how much rehearsal this person does and how much that one does, and how whether you sort of look forward to that or if that, after a while, gets to be really tiresome and tedious.
You can't get enough rehearsal. You really rehearse on film when you think about the way a play is rehearsed, and that's almost a luxury in filmmaking today. I was recently in Austin for the Austin Film Society Hall of Fame Awards, and I flew down. I got to fly down with my family, and they had a jet. I don't do a lot of flying around in private jets, but I got to fly down.
It's
with
nice, though, right?
Oh, wonderful. My kid, especially my daughter Lydia, she said, there's candy in every drawer. But Ann Margaret was there, I mean, a legend, and they were honoring her for State Fair, which was made here in the early 60s, and they showed a routine from that, and she was talking about it. She's accepted her award. That we rehearsed in those days, and she felt like that was a big thing about the work. I we're gypsies. We ran away and joined the circus. The wonderful thing about the craft of motion picture filmmaking is it is one of the last of the guild crafts and represents so many of the arts and crafts. Everything from the music, well, that's really at the end, the music's added, but, you know, all the art direction and the lighting and the costuming, which was really what I fell in love with, the illusion, the artifice of it all. But it's a great sense of camaraderie we all have. And so we kind of band together wherever we are, whether we meet in Rome or whether we meet in Pacoima, you know, it doesn't really make any difference. It's a great band of brothers. There's a great spirit of filmmakers, just like I think in any craft where there's all kinds of levels of experience.
Is it strange to grow so close to the same group of people that you're working with on a project and then sort of disband? They're off to the next thing. You may not see them for 5 years.
It can become absolutely incestuous sometimes, but yes, it is. It is. And some of those relationships stick and not always the ones you'd think over the years. And again, it's a small enough industry where you do cross and like for example with the AFI Dallas Film Festival here, a lot of great people, a lot of kind of old Hollywood, present day Hollywood, future Hollywood people, and you know, everyone you'll talk to, they all came from different places like Aledo, Texas or wherever, and went out to Hollywood to make some. I always consider California still kind of a 49er mentality. Everyone's out there to kind of toil. And I come back to Dallas and I think, gosh, what a great quality of life and the architecture and the museums and the restaurants and the people. I'm thinking, I'm out there because that's where I get my work.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the film industry and Texas. You know, in Texas, there's always been a huge push, particularly in the last couple of decades, to make sure that films get made here, and lots of people would love for there to be sort of there are probably half a dozen cities in this country that want to be the third coast. But is that something that people in California look at and say, come on, it's either New York or L.A.?
I don't know. Not at all. Again, we're gypsies of the world. We'd love to come down to Texas, look at these incredible landscapes and these skies and just, and again, like I would love to make a movie down here just today, like, for example, with these kind of overcast skies in this early spring, and she's almost like a gray lady walking around these beautiful streets and, again, looking at this architecture. For me, I've kind of come back to kind of poke a stick at my past a little bit because I grew up in Fort Worth. But I don't think there's that stigma at all. No, not at all. I think it's taken Texas filmmakers to kind of put Texas filmmaking on the map as opposed to trying to lure Hollywood producers and directors to coming down here by offering big sound stages and stuff like that. I think it's tough because I guess from what I understand, because Texas doesn't have a state income tax, it's hard to funnel money off. And, you know, producers are looking for a kind of these payback situations. We'll spend $2 million on the budget of the film. We're going to spend most of that around, like, say, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And in return, you'll give us, like, $200,000 back and kind of some kind of a rebate situation to create an incentive that way. I guess, you know, New Mexico and Louisiana are really aggressive in that regard, and because they've created situations. A lot of the filmmaking goes there. I was yesterday at Sambuco Restaurant. We sat down with the Dallas Association of Directors and Producers, and we were talking about that as well. Yeah. How do you get more production to come down here?
We're going to take a quick break and be back in just a minute with Bill Paxton. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, where the worlds of Michelangelo, Muhammad, and Matisse are yours to explore. Curious? Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is actor, director, and producer Bill Paxton. He is in town for the AFI Dallas International Film Festival with a movie called The Good Life. Of course, he's the star of HBO's Big Love. You can join our conversation today by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk first to Jeff in Dallas. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I just have a question for you about weird science. Who did you pattern the character Chet after, and what was it like to work with John Hughes? I guess it's a two-part question. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay,
you
thanks.
You cannot escape that movie,
a
can
lot.
You?
No, you know what? It's great. you've gotten to do something that becomes kind of part of the popular culture, even on a cult level like Weird Science. It's kind of fun. And, you know, Chet is with me here. He's still inside. Chet was kind of modeled after... Oh, I think watching too much Gomer Pyle and Sergeant Carter yelling at Gomer Pyle. I always enjoyed that. And I think I went to a lot of summer camps, boy, and I think I got a lot of it from – there were always at these different camps, whatever level you were at, how many years you've gone to the camp. There were different – like one camp I went to had different programs. There was the yearling program, the rough rider program, the top hand. You had to go on the rough ride, and it was a rite of passage. And there was a lot of stuff that happens at camp that were – you had that kind of big brother mentality coming from some of the counselors and some of the, particularly the older campers. So I kind of mixed it all up in the blender and, a generous helping of Niedermeyer from Animal House, of course, who was great. So it just kind of came out that way. You know, I would get my early jobs. I realized early on that sometimes if you went off the page and kind of riffed, I'm not a improvisational actor by any means, but I would have a few cards up my sleeve, and I threw something in, like I think even at the audition I threw in the line about the greasy pork sandwich, a line that my father dearly loved to bestow upon my brother and I when we were kind of seniors in high school, and he knew we'd been out having some at a beer bust or something like that. We were hungover on a Saturday morning. He'd say, "Gee, you look like you're not feeling too good. How about a nice greasy pork sandwich served in a dirty ashtray?" "Oh, Dad, cut it out." But my father has influenced every role I've played, and including, you know, even becoming an actor in the first place. He took me to so many great plays at the TCU Playhouse growing up, and of course, all the great movies I saw in the old movie palaces. John Hughes was one of those guys who had a very good ear. Him and Anthony Michael Hall could almost finish each other's sentences. It was one of the great actor-director pairings of that era, which I guess would be the 80s. I got to watch The Breakfast Club with Anthony Michael Hall the first time John showed it to him, which was in a bungalow on the Universal lot. As we were getting into pre-production, I won that part at an audition level. I remember getting the call, checking in with my agent, or I checked my machine, my service. You had a service in those days.
Yeah, you called up and they told you what your messages were.
Yeah,
right?
And I got a call to call my agent, which that never happened. The agent never called. And I was out at Zuma Beach. I was out there with my brother Steve and his girlfriend at the time. And I used a payphone there, and I called in, and she said, "Guess what?" I said, "Oh, gosh, what?" And she said, "You got the part of Chet in Weird Science." And you could have heard me, because I knew it was a great role. You know, I've kind of do a lot more kind of more leading type of things, but it's the character roles, I think, that you're most remembered for, and particularly getting to play kind of the archetypical brother. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Is it as exciting for you today to find out that you've got a role that you really want as it was back then? Or have you had it happen so many times now that it's not such a big deal?
No. My wife and I have a kind of a little jig we do together, which is really just like a couple of kids. We hold hands and we kind of jump up and down in a circle. And now my kids kind of join in. You got to understand, we're really kind of glorified migratory workers in many ways. The circus is only on kind of in a seasonal way in terms of the work you're going to get or not get. And, boy, there's fewer and fewer jobs. You know, they don't need as many pickers this year. And as you get older, the pickings get even slimmer.
Is it the same for men as it is for women? Because, you know, you hear women, they're either playing like this really sexy under 30 woman or grandma, and there's not much room in between. Is it? It's better for men, certainly.
It's the same for everyone.
Really?
Maybe there is. Yeah, I'm sure. I guess men are in our society, you know, people accept men's age more. You know, it's okay for the old guy. Like, I'm the old guy with the, you know, the young wives and all of that. But I don't know. I think it's a struggle for anyone. It's a hard career to maintain. You never really get a chance to rest on your laurels.
Are you afraid to enjoy time off?
Yes, I I've read this by a lot of very prominent, much more prominent than I've been in the business in terms of their careers. But everyone kind of can agree. You always think that your last job is your last job, and when it's over, you're kind of okay. Well, they come to take you away, and it's a weird kind of life because in a way you're put on the shelf. I mean, look, if there are actors who I greatly admire who fill their time by doing all kinds of theater. I've been more, I don't know in terms of where I fit in on the scale, but of performers, but I've been more of a film actor predominantly. I mean, so predominantly. I did a few plays starting out. I love going to plays. I love the theater, but I like originating characters. And I guess I like, again, like I was speaking about earlier, you know, going back to my earliest memories of coming out of movie theaters and my father making us aware of, like, the props or the costuming or something like that, and I loved all that. I guess I like the idea of photography and maybe it making a document. Who knows? It represents your passage in a way.
Now, you've gotten your dad cast in at least a couple of things, right?
I have, but I've probably not been the kindest person in terms of helping my father's career. I was early on, and then I realized, what have I gotten myself into? What have I unleashed?
Is he giving you direction now? Or?
absolutely. What have I unleashed upon the world? And I helped my dad get his my partner of many years from Fort Worth, Tom Huckabee, his wife, Barbara Cohen. She cast a movie years ago called Paranoia. It starred Bill Pullman, and I played one of the characters in it. And there were a bunch of actors, George Kennedy and Bud Cort from Harold and Maude. And my dad got a job as on the board of directors in this one scene where we were in the scene with George Kennedy. And through that, he was able to get his SAG card. And then he was relentless. He thought you could, if you made enough calls, because he was in the lumber business. He wholesaled hardwoods. It was a company that wholesaled hardwoods. It was
so he's
a family concern.
Cold calling.
He would go. His MO would be this. As a salesman, he'd realize, okay, I'm going to. He would travel all through the Midwest, all the way from the Gulf, all the way up through Minnesota. And he'd go, how can I optimize the most calls? He called on cabinet makers, musical instrument makers, any kind of fine woodworkers. Some were big. It might be an account like Gibson Guitar. It might be just a mom-and-pop cabinet shop. He'd go, hey, did you get the catalog? Are you happy with the product? So he thought he could apply the same tactics to getting work in Hollywood. And so, but anyway, the clever thing he used to do is he'd hire an off-duty policeman or fireman ahead of time and have them drive him around a rented car he had rented, pay them, and he'd give them, he'd say, here are 25 places I need to go today. And he'd say, will you make the route up and be there with the car? He didn't have to spend all that extra time in a foreign place because he was in different cities. He might be in Lincoln, Nebraska or wherever. And so anyway, he started doing that, writing letters, calling people, following them up, trying to get auditions. And he found that it was very, very tough. But he's found a great ally in a great filmmaker, Sam Raimi, who's put my dad in the last three Spider-Man films, and he's coming out in Memorial Day in Spider-Man 3. John Paxton stars with Tobey Maguire.
Is that how the billing goes and everything?
Yeah, exactly. That's the way it should go in my world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's talk next to Rob in Wichita Falls. Hey, Rob.
Hello there.
Howdy.
Hey, one observation, one question. Imagine everyone you talk to remembers you for a different role. My favorite, personally, five words, game over, man, game over.
Hmm.
You do seem to have a knack for finding a comedic twist, even in a serious role, and I wondered if you have a particular thought process by which you are able to do that.
Well, that's a good question, and I do. I do try to find it. I don't always succeed. It is an entertaining medium. The actors that I've admired most growing up, for different reasons, but one of the great actors in terms of that exact thing is Jack Nicholson. in any Jack Nicholson performance, which is something as tragic that just makes you cry at the end of something like as great as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. There's always that sense of humor. Five Easy Pieces, you remember the chicken salad sandwich scene. And he always finds that way of, I guess it has to do with a certain relish. I guess they used to call it panache. And, you know, you want to, to me, it's not really about, the portrayal is not necessarily all about trying to be convincing in the role that you're playing. You have to kick it a little bit. You got to give it some spin. You got to put some backspin on it if you're hitting a 7-iron. You know, you got to, and if you can do that, and you can, if you can get that in there, it's always what my father-in-law, who was English, used to call very good value. That actor is very good value.
Do you keep a sort of mental file of peculiar people that you meet in the world and use those later on? Or do you, does everything come out of your head?
It breaks down different ways. You break down the clues that the script offers you. You know, you really have to kind of put it together in a strangely forensic way. But then once you've set your imagination to it and your thought process, you find very quickly, and this applies to everything too, that your mind becomes kind of like a lighthouse, almost like a beacon. You're sweeping the horizon, and things come to you when you're maybe taking a shower or walking down the street. I find you need to get out. I love to do research. Anything you can do that gives you the feeling that you own the part, and you know, and also you can't go over your lines enough to really get them down so cold that you can, once you've done all that work, really the memorization and that part, it comes at the very end. I think a lot of people jump to that too soon. So by the time if they go backwards in that process, they've kind of killed the words before they've really understood them.
So they go words first, emotion
yeah,
second, as opposed to the other way.
You can do a cold reading, that's fine, but really as a portrayal, I don't try to learn the text. That's the last thing I do. But, you know, it's a paradoxical kind of a job in a way. It's kind of a job for me, it's like a job I love that I know I'll probably never get right. But it's a great challenge. And it's hard to keep working. I love comedy. I love anything like that. But it's hard to find good material.
When you do take after take after take of a scene, is there always is there always one sort of aha moment where you think, okay, that's the one? And you may or may not be in control of whether that gets printed, but or do you feel like it continues to evolve and it could go this way or it could go that way?
It's usually the one I do in the car on the way home as I'm slapping my forehead going, oh,
there's my Oscar.
It's not even that. It's just, I'm not awards driven. I don't think most of us who are in this business are. I mean, that's a gratis thing. It's it's gravy. It's about nailing the part at that moment or nailing that moment. And so for me, it's usually going home. It's almost, I wish we could film the scene the next day after we filmed it, because that's when I get my greatest insights.
You said once about 10 years ago that the way you chose roles was one for the critics, one for the kids. One for the critics, one for the kids. Does that still work for you?
You know what? That's a funny quote, because that sounds like it's at my discretion, you know, which it's not. You know, you're cast into the fates. Your stock is up and down. I someone was showing me, and I guess this has been going on for some time, your star meter is up or down. It's ridiculous. But
that could make you crazy, right? Following
it can totally make you crazy. So you just try to keep working and keep going and try not to gather too much dust on the shelf.
1-800-933-5372 is our phone number. My guest today is actor, director, and producer Bill Paxton. Let's talk next to Lewis in Denton. Hi, Lewis.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, Lewis. Denton, Bill? I saw. That's where they filmed Bonnie and Clyde years ago.
I was, in fact, the assistant projectionist the night they premiered Bonnie and Clyde.
Lewis, oh, my God, Lewis. Oh, God, buddy. Lewis Abernathy.
I also went on a cruise with you once. I don't know if
you remember. To the Titanic, to the bottom of Davy Jones' locker. Lewis, how the hell are you, pal?
I'm doing real well. I'm alive and well in Denton. I just got back from the circus myself and doing a little decompressing before I run off to join another one.
Before we go any further, Lewis, I have to explain to the listeners who, you know, Lewis Abernathy, I was almost his foil in Titanic. Lewis and I, we both have a long, long association with Jim Cameron going way back. He cast us both to be in Titanic. We're in the modern day part of the story. And Lewis, I'm trying to interview old Rose, and Lewis is all over me. And Lewis gives the great description of how the ship actually sank, how it struck the iceberg and broke in half. And Gloria Stewart says, thanks for that forensic observation. However, the experience was somewhat different. And it's just, it was an incredible moment for us. And anyway, you knucklehead, what are you doing?
I slapped her.
You're the comedy relief. You sure are. Come out and see me while I'm here.
That's why I'm calling, But
I'm around.
Hey, why don't I leave my number with the radio station and you can call me back?
I'd love to.
I'm going to put you on hold, Lewis, okay?
Cheers, Lewis.
All right.
Thanks for calling. 1-800.
Lewis Abernathy, ladies and gentlemen.
933-5372 is the phone number. If you want to send an email, you can send that to think@kera.org. We have a stack of emails, Bill, asking when Big Love is coming back.
Big Love is, we're going to follow the final chapters of Sopranos, which is everyone's...
What a horrible lead-in.
Yeah, isn't that terrible? Wow. But they're going to finish. I think they start up in the next couple weeks. They finish June 10th, Sunday. We pick up Sunday, June 17th, and there's going to be a lot going on this season.
And are you guys on DVD as well, the first season?
The first season, yes, is available on DVD.
Yeah, and they're... things are very different this year. For the family.
The flame's been turned up a little bit on the stove, and all kinds of things are coming out of the woodwork. And now that all the characters are up to speed with the audience, now they can really start pushing some story. And we have a lot of new characters joining the show. It's going to be what I'm calling the mother load. We're going to meet the other two mother-in-laws this year in the form of Bonnie Bedelia, who's going to be playing Jennifer Goodwin, Margene's mother. Comes in Ginger. She doesn't know that Margene's in a polygamous relationship. And then Ellen Burstyn joins us as Jean Triplehorn's mother.
Wow.
And, that's going to be something, too.
Bill Paxton is my guest. We're going to take another quick break and then return. If you'd like to call and ask a question, the number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. And you can see Bill Paxton's film, the latest, The Good Life, at the AFI Dallas International Film Festival, which premieres on the 22nd, which is today. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults, where the worlds of Michelangelo, Muhammad, and Matisse are yours to explore. Curious? Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. My name is Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is actor and director Bill Paxton. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, and you can email think@kera.org. What's the unwritten rule, Bill, for sort of recognizing people that you've worked with in the past? You had the call from Lewis, and I'm wondering if there are people that you remember having worked with. And
He bushwhacked me.
But I mean, like,
Lewis, you dirty dog.
Are there people that you see on the street or in different places that, do they automatically recognize you because you're the big star and you don't necessarily remember them? Or do you have to play that game where you say, oh, good to see you again? How does that work for you?
I think I've always been taught to be diplomatic in any situation because of my father. And again, he was a real people person. And it's human nature to, when you see someone out of context and not necessarily, the Rolodex is spinning, but it's not clicking in. You're not getting the intel from your brain that you need at that moment. And yeah, I think your eyes kind of glaze over just a bit. You might look people in the eye too much.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you know, you're just trying to be polite. Gosh, you travel a lot and, my memory isn't what it used to be. I think I just, my, wicked ways are catching up with me.
Is it hard for you to be recognizable wherever you go? Because you can't just sit there and people watch, can you?
No, not at all. I actually can. I asked for some directions trying to find the Dallas Museum of Art from the hotel I'm staying in. I just wanted to go for a walk and had a beautiful morning there and at the Nasher Sculpture Garden. Just great. And there was a couple there that gave me directions and they didn't know me from Adam. It was wonderful. And I've been lucky enough to – And I think it's because I'm kind of a plain Jane in many ways. I'm able to kind of blend in for the most part. My voice gives me away. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of times if I keep my yap shut, as my wife so helpfully points out, we can have our dinner and feast. But I've never been someone who gets mobbed or anything. And I'm a people person like my father was. And we are ambassadors for the business we're in. Sometimes it can be inconvenient, you know, and some people, just on an animal sense, you need 17 inches. You know, if people get too into your face on something, you're kind of like, gee, you want to be polite, but you want to, you know, get the hell out of there.
Have some personal space, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't have a problem with that. And I it's great to, my father worked for his dad, the Frank Paxton Lumber Company. Their slogan was Beautiful Woods, and it started in Kansas City. And I remember going down to the lumber yard in Fort Worth, and there was, I think, a distribution yard here in Dallas as well. There was something when my dad would call in the trade. I remember going on trips with him and calling on woodworkers and walking in and saying, John Paxton, Frank Paxton Lumber Company. It was kind of nice, you know. It had some pride, personal pride. And I get that as an actor. I'm very proud of some of the work. I wish I could say all of it. There is a sense of pride, and I like talking to people. And you see them kind of light up in a way. It's almost for them like maybe seeing a ghost, really, because people are used to seeing you in a two-dimensional world.
And in
suddenly
character.
There you are, and you know, and it's so it can be a lot of fun, too, for the most part. If you're with your kids, your family, or you're doing something kind of personal, then you feel a little more protective, you know, so the paranoia sets in.
Do you work with wood at all, or is that part of, you know, do you collect?
Yes, I like to work with wood.
Do you really?
I have made wood projects. I live in the country. I live outside of Los Angeles. And, you know, my kids and I, we've built different things. Our last big project was a tree house. Of course, I had some
help.
That
sounds ambitious.
It was very ambitious. I ended up needing a lot of help on that. But
so did you just check off the plans, or did you actually swing a hammer?
I did a little bit of both, yeah. Maybe a little on a lot more of the planning, but I had to be there for the execution. But also, I've made different things with wood. There's a great reverence for wood in terms of working with it. There's something very, I don't know, it's of the earth and just wonderful, tactile to touch things. And I've always loved the beauty of wood in so many ways. It adds such a warmth, and it's organic, and you got to protect the wood, though. I mean, my family don't chop down the trees. We just so anyway. Yes, it's. I'm not like a, I guess wouldn't. I wouldn't say a passionate woodworker. I know a lot of people who are, though. They seem to get once they get into it, it becomes almost an obsession. Grace Zabriskie, who plays my mother on Big Love, great actress, that's her. Her other passion is woodworking. She does all kinds of incredible wood sculptures.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's talk next to Deborah in Dallas. Hi, Deborah.
Oh, hi. I believe that your guest wrote and I think directed a movie called Frailty several years ago. And I just wanted, if that's true, I just wanted to get some comments on however that inspiration came. Honestly, that was one of the most affecting movies I've seen in the past several years, and I just wondered about the inspiration for that.
Well, I have to give credit. The inspiration came from the amazing script, screenplay, Frailty, written by Brent Hanley, who is from the Dallas area. I was just with Brent in Austin, Texas, a couple weeks ago at South by Southwest. He had his first film, a short, that he directed, playing there. And I got to say, that script just bowled me and Tom Huckabee, my producing partner, my old friend from Fort Worth, over. And we convinced David Kirshner, who was the other producer on the show, to maybe let me be in it. And he wanted me to act in it. And then I said, would you consider me as the director? We had a lot of fun putting that together. We changed the name of the town. It was supposed to actually be set in Tyler, Texas. In the script, it was Tyler. But we didn't really want to get people to maybe go over there and start digging up their rose garden in the middle of the night looking for demons. So we changed the name to Thurman, just kind of out of respect. And my character worked over in Jupiter. And at the end of the movie, it takes place in Meat, Texas. And they were just kind of, they sounded like towns that you'd find in Texas. But I thought that was a great script. I recruited some incredible people like Powers Booth and Matthew McConaughey. The boys were awesome. I kind of discovered them. Matthew O'Leary, who played the main role, the older brother, did a phenomenal job.
His face, each time he looks at your character, like, what is going on here? It's brilliant.
It had a great, you know, through his point of view, the story is told, most of the story in the past, which is predominantly the movie. He had a great face for that, very expressive. And we actually premiered the movie here at the Deep Ellum Film Festival. I'm here supporting Michael Caine and the AFI, the Dallas inaugural film festival that's starting tonight. But I got to come down and show Frailty here at Deep Ellum, and it was a great experience, just a great experience.
Is the experience of making like an independent film really all that different from making a studio picture?
No, I think the main difference probably would be in the story themselves. Obviously, independent films depend on being more character-driven, which is usually, I think, more appealing to most actors because there's obviously some character analysis in there. But I mean, there's a validity for every kind of film, I think, you know. No, I guess not.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Going next to Tanya in Dallas. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hey, I had a couple of questions. First, I have to tell you, I really loved you in Club Dread.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. I don't get to do a lot of comedy. We were talking about some other comic roles earlier.
I wanted to find out if you had a good time working on it, because I've not seen you do anything quite like that.
Too much fun. I kind of, Sam Elliott, I worked with years ago on Tombstone. I got to play his kid brother, and I kind of took a little Sam Elliott beef, it's what for dinner. And then, of course, there was a, you know, happy helping of Jimmy Buffett in there. My character had written Pina Colada Berg and was ripped off by that other guy. And I had a lot of fun, the idea of playing kind of a burned out musician who has this resort island. The guys who made it were a crazy bunch of guys named Broken Lizard, who had made Super Troopers. And I really like these guys. You don't see too many comedy teams anymore, like the Marx Brothers and those kind of teams, and or Monty Python or Fire Sign Theater, which I grew up with. So it was kind of cool to meet these guys. They all met in college up at Colgate in New York, and they've kind of formed this band of brothers, and they make these comedies. Their latest is Beer Fest. Unfortunately, they didn't call me up for that one. I love to do comedy roles. You don't get to do a lot of comedy.
Is a comedy actually any less stressful than a dramatic film, or are they all pretty much the same?
Dying is easy.
Making somebody else laugh.
Comedy.
That'll kill you.
You know what? I think you can't go wrong if you're playing the character. If for me anyway, I think if you're intent on the character's goals and because of either the situation or whatever the predicament is, that's really where the character of that person you're portraying, that's really where the comedy comes from. Unfortunately, on a lot of shows, and I have a lot of friends who work on different things, you see the actors are almost forced to hit the joke so hard. I mean, you know, with the canned laughter and just the whole thing, and it's a drag to have to do that kind of, I guess, indicative performing. What's fun about Big Love, you can be so much more subtle about it. It can just be, you know, you don't even have to raise an eyebrow in some of the situations with this guy with these three wives. So I guess situation kind of dictates how you do it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Bill Paxton is my guest. Let's go next to Jerry in Heath. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I just got a question. Do you do your research on the characters? Do you go to bars, Walmart, churches to listen in and develop things? And how good is that In-N-Out burger?
Oh, gosh. I move around. Like I said earlier, I like to kind of hide in plain sight. And I think it's hard to kind of create in a vacuum for any of us. We're all inspired by what we see and what we experience around us, and certainly by other people who've gone before us in our chosen pursuits or whatever. So I have to go on, but I tell you, the guy who kind of primes my pump is my acting coach, Vincent Chase. I'll usually see him and we'll talk about a part and kind of break it down and, just talk about the character on the social aspects of the character, his background. What are the clues in the script that reveal the thing? Because you got to always remember you're bringing the ideas of the character that are, you know, that the author wrote, whether it's the screenwriter or the playwright, and you know, you kind of start there. But I do all kinds of stuff. I'm not a big internet guy, but because I find a lot of the information that sometimes, well, it's not just that. It's just I'm kind of still kind of a Luddite in many aspects, but I like to read books and move around, you know, meet people, see what I can do. It's kind of fun. It's like detective work.
Are you still making music?
No, that was really kind of a sidebar thing. I grew up around a lot of great musicians. Stephen Bruton was one who tried to teach me how to play the guitar. He's down in Austin now and has played with a lot of great acts and done a lot of great solo work. But, you know, I guess I really became an actor because I never practiced enough, Stephen. But I think got to remember in the context of when I grew up here, kind of in the 60s and early 70s, when I really kind of came of age and was a teenager, and all the music that was coming out of, you know, rock and roll and the huge acts. I remember getting to see Jimi Hendrix at Will Rogers Coliseum when I was about 13 and just things like that. So the music was, I wanted to be in music, but so when this Martini Ranch came around, a friend of mine was really who spearheaded that, was really the arranger, and I got involved with that.
Who calls you Wild Bill?
I was called Wild Bill by different people in different situations, but the guy who kind of coined it on me was an English director who directed Quadrophenia, Frank Rodham, and he was doing his first American movie, which was called The Lords of Discipline. It was based on a Pat Conroy novel, and we shot it in England, and I was the last of about 12 actors that was kind of the cutoff point, had a small minor supporting role, and who got to go over to England to film the movie. And so I remember my first day of filming, it was kind of a scene where we're hazing these new cadets. It's a set of a dormitory at Twickenham Film Studios. And I was very nervous. And we'd been there for about 2 weeks. Frank was really smart about getting us to kind of get into the character. He really gave us a lot of help. He had soldiers there to teach us how to march and the different etiquette of these Carolina Institute. The Citadel was what the school that was depicted in the story. We got in there, and the first day of filming, I was pretty nervous, and I had to be this kind of upperclassman who's hazing these new recruits. And he comes up and he says, "Bill, I just have one piece of direction, Bill." And I say, "Frank, what is it?" And he says, "It's a great day for Texas." And he repeats it. "It's a great day for Texas. Okay, let's roll one." And it was a great piece of direction. It gave me great confidence, and it was a great experience. And so when the film came out, he had him put on the credits Wild, you know, in parentheses, Bill Paxton.
And that's the only time you've been Wild Bill in the credits, right?
Yes. My agent thought, gee, if you decided to Shakespeare, I don't quite see, there was no fear of that.
Actor, director, producer, and Fort Worth native Bill Paxton is in town for a screening of his film, The Good Life, at the AFI Dallas International Film Festival. Thank you so much for being with us.
Gee, it was really painless, like I said.
Well, that's what we strive for.
Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Watch Think, the television show, tomorrow evening at 7:30 on KERA 13. Made possible by the Dallas Center for the Performing Arts, Guarantee Bank, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.